into state government. With these skills, he led Indiana to the first balanced budget in 8 years, and without a tax increase, transformed a $600 million deficit into an annual surplus of $390 million. He also repaid millions of dollars the state had borrowed from the public schools, universities, and local units of government in previous administrations, while presiding over record-breaking investment and job growth. Today, Indiana has a AAA credit rating, the first in the state's history, and rates near the top of every national ranking of business attractiveness. His other groundbreaking accomplishments include the 2006 lease of the Indiana Toll Road, the largest privatization of public infrastructure in the United States to date, and it generated nearly $4 billion for reinvestment in the state's record-breaking 10-year transportation and infrastructure program, and the creation of the Healthy Indiana Plan to provide health care coverage for uninsured Hoosier adults. A sweeping property tax reform in 2008 resulted in the biggest tax cut in Indiana history, and an emphasis on government efficiency has led to many of the state agencies, including the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, Department of Child Services, and Department of Correction, winning national performance awards. Because of all this, he was reelected in 2008, of course, to his final term, receiving more votes than any candidate for public office in the state's history. To no one's surprise, his second term has been as innovative as his first. In fact, earlier this year, under his guidance, Indiana passed the most expansive education reforms in the country. His new book, Keeping the Republic, Trusting Americans to Save America, proves that he is and will continue to be the role model for government reform in America. We'll have an opportunity to purchase a copy, as Pat said, and have it signed by the author at the close of today's meeting. Sherry Daniels and the couple's four daughters are a great source of pride and joy. She endeared herself to free-spirited souls everywhere when several years ago she won the watermelon spitting contest at the Indiana State Fair. Governor, downtown Kiwanis and its foundation owe you a sincere debt of gratitude for your support of our Abe Lincoln Scholarship Program. Your congratulatory letters to the winners, praising them for overcoming life's vicissitudes, have no doubt had a very positive impact on their lives. Please give a rousing Kiwanis welcome to the man who makes us all proud to be Hoosiers, Governor Mitch Daniels.
Thank you, Mark. I think that was quicker than 4.5 minutes. Thank you, everyone. I hope everyone in the far end zone can hear me well. I've tried to discipline our team to put podia and microphones in the middle of long rooms like this, but I guess sometimes it doesn't work. I hope you can see this, and for those who can't, I'll try to fill in the blanks for you. Thanks to the Kiwanians for this opportunity. It's a timely one. This is the time of year in which we've customarily tried to lay out some thoughts about the next set of steps we can take to make Indiana a better state, a more promising state. And your kind invitation fit that bill very, very well. Thank you for indulging us or allowing me this podium and this opportunity to share a few thoughts with you and our fellow citizens as we do it. I got all dressed up for you. I hope you noticed that and appreciate it. I got my governor's suit on, which I avoid on probably too many occasions. And sometimes that throws people. I'll have to be careful when all those visitors in town for the Super Bowl, because a few years ago, a bunch of us went up to the James Dean Festival at Fairmount, rode motorcycles because the weather was nice, so I looked like people do when you ride motorcycles. And I was going through greeting people, and I got to some fellas sitting on folding chairs in front of there was an old car show as a part of it. Classic cars, I love them. In front of the Mercury section, as I recall, these guys are sitting there, and I started saying hi, and I could tell it wasn't quite registered, and I said, are y'all Hoosiers, or could you possibly be visitors to our state? And the guy said, yeah, no, we're from St. Louis. We brought our cars up here to display them. I said, oh, okay, fine. I said, I thought so. I said, well, I tell them who I am and why. I said, that's why I was bothering you. So I move on down, to the Plymouth section or whatever came next, and one of my friends is trailing right behind me, and as he goes by these guys, one of them said to the other, who did he say he was? He said he's the governor of Indiana. The guy said, right, and I'm Colonel Sanders. I stay overnight in people's homes. I notice, you have, sometimes other people clean up for you. One of my recent overnights was a little different. Instead of a home, I stayed in a men's dormitory at Notre Dame. I had like a 2-hour bull session the night before, or whatever they call it these days, with about 10 really impressive young men at Alumni Hall dormitory. So 7 a.m. the next morning, I'm easing out of there quietly to get the day started, and it's pretty quiet in a college dorm at that hour these days, I get. And the only people around, there's two ladies standing there, obviously waiting for me. And I greeted them, and it turned out they were Cindy and Diane, and they are the custodians, they're the cleaning ladies for this 240-man dorm. And they wanted to get a picture taken. So as we're doing that, one of them says, could you come back real soon? I said, well, I'd like that, but it might be a while. Why? She said, this place has never looked so good as the last 2 days. I said, I thought it looked kind of tidy compared to what I recall, and it's not always like this. Oh, no, she said. So, what I thought we'd do, I will give you a very quick review of where we stand as a state, report to shareholders style. And then I would like to share with you some thoughts about the legislative session, which is going to start here pretty soon, and some things I think we can do to, in the constant quest to improve our state and the prospects for the young people who we want to grow up and thrive in it. I've been starting a lot of these presentations lately with this cartoon out of the New Yorker, so if you can't see it in the back, the doctor says to the forlorn patient, sometimes it helps to turn a question around. Why not you? This is the governor of Illinois over here on the left, if you didn't recognize him. And there are a lot of governors that have reason to feel a little dejected these days. I could keep here all afternoon with clippings like this. You're seeing a lot of them anyway. Just in place after place after place, very difficult things being done, very unfortunate things to public services or to taxpayers or to both. Arizona shortening its school day, California having already cut billions of dollars. Governor Brown was forced to announce through a trigger mechanism their budget. They're probably going to take 7 more days off the school year in California, which is a backdoor way of slashing education spending. So just to say that we have been very, very determined that Indiana would not be one of these places, and some people have worked very hard on your behalf to see that that didn't happen. This is, I got a little light here. This is the track from 2001 over here on the left, 2011, the year we just finished, fiscal 12, the year we're in, and the forecast for the year to follow. And this traces the trajectory of Indiana's reserves dwindling and dwindling, going into the red for 3 years. The state owed money beyond the cash it had, and then building back out of that to the position we're in now, which projects to something like 12% of the next year's budget in reserve come next June 30th. We hope that'll be the case, but that is the most recent projection. If that happened, you've read a little about this lately, it would trigger a new provision in Indiana law, an automatic taxpayer refund. Very simple concept, but based, to me, on a very fundamental principle. The concept is that when the state's books are honestly balanced, there are no gimmicks involved, when there is more than a safe amount, a secure amount, at least a specified amount, in the savings account, in those reserves we just looked at, that the government ought to stop collecting money, ought to leave it with the people who earned it. We put this in law not believing that it was likely to be triggered anytime soon, but it might be in this year. And if it were, it would average to, on the forecast that just came out, it would come out to just over $50 a person, or a little over $100 on a joint return. There are about 2.2 million Hoosiers who file on a joint return. They would share $100 roughly. About a million plus who file individually, about $50 reduction, or whatever they owed. So we'll see how it works out, but it is, when I campaigned on the idea, it was not only about the fact that it's not the government's money, it's your money. Government sometimes forgets that. But I also made the point that better that it stay in the pockets of the people who earned it than burn a hole in the pockets of government. And there are a lot of states on those headlines we looked at there who got in trouble specifically because they had a lot of money back in the bubble years, and they spent it, and they committed to more spending, and the next thing they knew, they were in deep trouble. Why is Indiana in that shape and other states aren't? Well, it's because we've made a very big move in a very few years. We now have the third or fourth lowest per capita state spending in the country. People in other states are always asking me, you know, how'd you guys turn this around and how'd you stay in good shape when all the rest of us went in the drink? And I say, oh, very mysterious. We spent less money than we took in. This is Indiana state debt, down 42% in the last few years. It's an interesting factoid because that's almost exactly what the other 49 states, or the 50 states collectively, went up. Their debts went up about a little over 40% in that very same time period. We now have the third lowest debt per capita in the country. And glad to be in that shape. We have a AAA bond rating as a consequence of that. There are currently 9 states that have one, but 2 of them are about to lose it, it appears, or on a watch list. This, I thought, was a very encouraging thing. The reason I put it up here is to make the following point. Yes, we've been economical in government the last few years, and we do look every single day for ways to stretch tax dollars, but not at the expense, never at the expense of important services. What this says, this is a survey done earlier this year, in which we ranked, there was only one state, Montana, was slightly better. Otherwise, Indiana was the highest ranking state in public opinion about the efficiency of government. By 77 to 16, Hoosiers said they thought their state government was efficient. And there's a very huge spread, as you can see from this sample, across states in that respect. We are not as good as we want to be. We are never going to be satisfied. But we measure everything. We reward people and departments based on how well or not well they're performing for you. And we take it as a source of some gratification that even in a very, very difficult period fiscally, Hoosiers affirm that they believe that their government is performing with some efficiency on their behalf. Indiana is now first in the nation at between 55 and 56% of every state dollar, every sales tax, income tax, corporate tax dollar that you pay, 56 cents goes to K-12 education. It's the highest such commitment in the country by a clear margin over second place. It's the highest, obviously, in state history. So not a lot of doubt about where our priorities are. When you put higher ed on top of this, two-thirds of the entirety of state government is committed to education. And the reason for this is we've sustained education spending and are increasing it in the current budget, even while it's being slashed in other places, And while we were cutting other departments as much as 25%, when you shrink everything else, when you grab and you squeeze as hard as you can on other things and sustain your top priority, you get an unusual, in fact, a unique ratio like this. You know, some folks who haven't looked outside our boundaries get exercised about a very modest one-time interruption of the constant increase in education spending in Indiana, which we then reversed and began increasing again in this budget. Just take a look around America, and you'll see that nobody has done a better job of protecting K-12 spending than we have. And here's the point I made a minute ago, that when you add higher ed to K-12, you've got two-thirds of the entire budget. Everything else, parks, state police, everything else, Medicaid, it's all crammed into that one-third of the pie. This is the, I'm transitioning here to our number one priority, which is jobs and economic growth. We have been very determined somehow to ride out this recession without raising taxes. Number one, we didn't want to make life any more difficult on families that were strapped as it was. Number two, we're in a competition and every single day for new jobs in this state. And I kept saying to our people every week, every time that someone else raises a tax and Indiana doesn't, we got just that little bit more competitive. And there's almost nobody left who hasn't, unless they're sitting on oil, gas, or other minerals, as those states are. Everybody who rates business climates these days has Indiana very near the top. Site Selection magazine. These are just the most recent ones. Site Selection. This is Area Development, which is, again, people who advise businesses where to look. This is the survey of chief executives by the magazine for them. It has been very frustrating, I must tell you, to have clawed our way very near the top, into the top tier in these rankings. It was the most important thing we ever thought we could do. I said, we're here to build the best sandbox in America. Everything else is a means to that end. Keeping spending down, keeping taxes down, quick and efficient regulation, building roads like nobody else in America. These are all means to the end objective of becoming a state with more economic opportunity. If we get that right, everything else gets easier. Tax revenues rise naturally. We'll have the money to do all the things that we want to do collectively. And it has been frustrating to get to that point at just the moment when the national economy hit the skids as it did. I keep saying to people, it's like being the prettiest girl in school and they called off the prom. But there is still some dancing going on, and we have had, as the year comes near, we're going to have a record year in terms of number of individual transactions. Not quite, I don't think, in terms of number of new jobs committed, but close to that. So even in this rotten economy, Indiana is moving ahead, but just not fast enough. So let's talk about 2012 and things we might do together to make our state even more attractive and even more successful. I want to start with something we've been working on already for 3 years, local government reform. And, never be done thanking former Governor Kernan and Chief Justice Randy Shepherd for the work they led. They gave us 27 or so excellent recommendations. About 6 or 7 have been acted on. It's not enough, and we need to do more. I'm very hopeful this year about action in maybe 4 other areas. One is to eliminate the conflict of interest, which is still rampant in Indiana. People are going to have to make a decision, not instead of double dipping, holding one public job and then serving on, let's say, a city council, voting on their own department's salaries and contracts and so forth. People are going to have to pick, and I believe we've got some good bipartisan interest in doing that. Nepotism, the same. A strikingly high percentage of the employees of township government have the same last name. Wouldn't be permitted in most states, and we should get rid of it here. Township reform, I hope at least township advisory boards, thousands of elected politicians with even the strong, and there are many sincere advocates of preserving township government itself, most of them do have trouble explaining at least what the advisory boards, why they are necessary. I'm also hopeful that we might give counties at least the option to consolidate townships or to move their responsibilities up to the county level. And then finally, again, probably on an optional basis, the possibility for counties to move to a single county commissioner. Now, of course, because of the Unigov reform here, Indianapolis has had a single executive for a long, long time. That is, of course, the rule almost everywhere in life. I always say, show me a baseball team with three managers, co-managers. Show me a military unit with three commanding officers. Show me a business with three CEOs. You know, would seem odd in any other context. So I'm hopeful that we'll at least give counties the opportunity to unify accountability in one commissioner, one executive, strengthen the legislative branch at the same time, the county council, and thereby have a system that more resembles the way representative government works everywhere else. Now, here's some more things I think we ought to do this year. I think the time has come for a statewide smoking ban. I think the evidence has grown. I think the public support has grown. Other states have been moving in this direction, and I think the time is right. There's some very good people in both parties. Representative Charlie Brown is a good example from the Democratic side, who've been working a long time in this vineyard, and I hope 2012 is the year that that they succeed. I'd like to try to help them. We're working with people who want to try to address the inequity of remote sellers. That is to say, you've been hearing a lot about this, but this exploding world of catalogs and internet and online retailing and so forth, there's an awful lot of taxes which are owed but not collected. I think of most of this as innocent tax evasion. Most citizens just don't even know that they still owe the sales tax, and it's very, very difficult, awkward for them to pay it even if they do know it. So we are working with people, again, in both parties who would like to address this, and I believe we can get a bill this session. One that I've taken increasing interest in recently, on the subject of higher education affordability, a growing problem. Young people taking striking amount of time to get through school, if they get through and complete at all. Spending a striking amount of money trying to do it and coming out with a striking amount of debt. And this is just a major, major problem. And first of all, we have to address it for the benefit of these young people who need the education and the credential, whatever it is, at the end of it, to get a good job in this economy. Second, I think we need to do this for the benefit of our schools themselves. Their business model, I think, is on borrowed time. Huge bricks and mortar facilities with very high fixed costs and very low productivity and very high administrative burdens, and a customer base which is starting to look around and say, you know what, I'm not sure that's worth it anymore. So a lot of things can be done about this, but one I think we ought to do right now, I've been visiting with the Commission on Higher Education about the issue nationally referred to as credit creep. And looking around this room, most of us, colleges back there a ways. And you'd be surprised at a lot of the data I have been, things I already mentioned, how long it takes, how few complete ever, how much it costs and so forth. You'd also be surprised how many credits it now takes to get a diploma conferred. And I'm not going to name any school names here, but it's really a pretty pervasive problem. But the idea here is the historical benchmark was around 120 credit hours for a four-year degree and about 60 for an associate degree. And we've got tons of programs way above that. And the idea would be to empower the Board of Higher Education to challenge any that are above those numbers and disallow them unless somebody can make a really good case. You know, 126 hours to get a sociology degree, not sure that's necessary. But it's costly, and it means that kids are really struggling no matter how hard they work, to get through in 4 years or even five. I think we ought to do something more for the victims of the State Fair tragedy. I don't support and will actively oppose raising the tort claims cap in this state. It's a perfectly good law, and it serves us well on almost every occasion. But this was an extraordinary event. Great outcome, really, I think, with every, as I understand it, every victim but maybe one having agreed to the sharing of the first $5 million. As you know, the state, nobody's found anybody negligent or liable of anything so far. Attorney General and I said, look, we're not going to make people wait years to settle all that in court. Let's go ahead and deliver the $5 million plus the million we raised privately. Get these families some compensation now. As well as that's worked out, I do think that probably at least something more on the in this unique, this extraordinary and tragic event can be justified, and within reason, I'll support it. This morning we had a news conference. The Attorney General, Senator Randy Head, Prosecutor Curry here from here in town was there too, about something that I confess I didn't know much about until several months ago, when from different directions, activists on behalf of children began visiting me and informing me more about this. There is just an absolutely abominable situation going on with the prostitution of young, typically young girls. Organized crime is involved. International crime is involved. It is horrendous. And there are loopholes, there are gaps in our law that make this very hard to prosecute or to deter. And this morning we announced a bill we think will close those gaps. Here's the thing that needs saying to leaders of this community. We need this law before the Super Bowl. The number one destination for criminals exploiting young girls is that event, large sporting events, and that's the largest one. And it is estimated that as many as 10,000 were transported into the last two Super Bowls, or into the metropolitan areas around the last two Super Bowls. And Miami, I guess it was, Dallas, I'm sorry, last year arrested 133 people. They think they barely skimmed the surface. So this is one that we not only ought to act on, but I think we ought to act on very, very promptly. The idea of a mass transit referendum possibility here and perhaps in Northwest Indiana is one I'm supportive of. This is not the comment on the merits of new taxes or the huge investments that might go in to mass transit, but I'm just keeping consistency here with the policy we've had since always, but was very important in the property tax reforms of 2008 and as constitutionalized in 2010. Point is, we will put these lids on and protect taxpayers, but if a local unit of government or a school district can make a good case for a little extra taxation, I think the people of that jurisdiction ought to have the right to be heard on it and to decide on it. So that's it's in keeping with that principle that I think it would be a good idea, and it seems that now's the time to give that opportunity to the people of an affected area. And in what I'm calling spring cleaning legislation, I asked the General Assembly and the House in particular took leadership here. All year they've been studying, ransacking Indiana code for obsolete, duplicative language. There's a ton of it. And there are all sorts of provisions in the law that are either antique or inconsistent with each other. And it appears they've come up with a pretty good package, actually a series of bills, and I'm going to support all of those. Let's modernize the code of Indiana so we, our citizens and those who represent them, have a little better chance of understanding it and dealing with it. Now, I talked yesterday about the issue of right to work, and I won't belabor it here, except to say that once again, jobs and economic opportunity is the single most important goal, has been for us for 7 years, and not without a lot of thought, and not without a lot of study, and not without some reservations. Now, I've decided that Indiana and our future will be well served by this job. It's all about new job opportunities. It is certainly true, the facts are really not in any dispute, that right-to-work states are growing jobs, growing income faster than those without. They have lower unemployment rates. It's not really in any dispute that the general notion, the general principle here, that it should be the worker's decision, this is about whether to pay dues or not, is strongly supported by Hoosiers. I've seen strings of surveys, and it's 2-1 or better. It's very important to notice, you know, this does not affect the fundamental rights of workers to organize collectively. If it did, I wouldn't be for it. But every right-to-work state has plenty of unions. Some of them have more unions, or say, should say higher rates of unionization than Indiana does. It has no effect whatsoever on the ability, if that's the worker's decision, to have a union. It only says that the decision about whether to join and whether to pay the dues will not be compulsory but voluntary. Teachers in Indiana already have that. State government employees in Indiana already have that. I can't find a reason to object to it in the private sector context. But here's the main thing. The main point for me has been the 7 years' experience that we have had, which says this is costing Indiana the very middle-class jobs that every state needs, that all of America needs. We've now done over 1,000 transactions since we created the Indiana Economic Development Corporation. And we've had record-breaking years, 7 years, even in the bad years, compared to past history. When we get a chance to compete, Indiana wins 2/3 of the time. But we have found, and we've been told for 7 years by the people who advise businesses where to look, that we are going to miss. We are simply not going to get to the table a quarter to a half the time if we don't have one of these laws. I've talked myself blue in the face to some of these people about, look, I show them those same maps I showed you. I said, you know, we're a darn good state apart from this. Some of them buy it, but many of them don't. And in this economy particularly, if the nation were in great shape, if we were booming, if this was 2008 and we were at full employment as we were in Indiana, I wouldn't be recommending this. That is not the case, and it's not likely to be the case, as far as I can tell, for a while. And so I think this step is necessary. I'm just going to stop right there with this comment. I know this last issue is going to be hotly debated and divisive. I appreciate that. And we don't undertake those lightly. But I do want to point out that we've got all kinds of opportunities, and I didn't name them all, but I named whatever I named, 7 of them here, or 8, or 12 if you count them individually. All sorts of opportunities that we to find room for agreement, and I hope bipartisan progress. And so I look forward to the next session. As I've looked forward to every session, I remember that at the end of my first year, or as the second year got nearer, I started talking to people about things I thought we ought to do. And the old sages said, well, now, you know, son, Mitt, it's an election year. It's a short session. We don't usually do too much. I said, don't do too much. Now, we can't skip a day, let alone a legislative session. We got too much work to do in this state. And so if you look back, there wasn't anything boring about 06 and 08 and 10. We're not going to let there be anything boring about 2012. We're going to make more headway. We're going to further distinguish Indiana from other states. And we're going to be able to say, yeah, that was another, we used another opportunity to leave a better state to our kids. Thank you for your attention, this forum, and for the questions I look forward to now. Thanks. So I can see you. I don't know if I'll hear you, but I can see you. Yes, sir.
What is the... Oh.
Are you talking about WGU Indiana?
What is WGU?
Yeah, well, I'm one of the main hucksters for that school. They They've had me do a couple there as well. I'll tell you, Tom, and because it's relevant to the credit creep issue I raised, for instance. All right. WGU stands for Western Governors University. It was created a couple, over two decades ago, out in the West, really to try to offer some sort, this was in the early days of the internet, but to offer some sort of distance learning opportunity to people who were spread out in the wide spaces of places like Utah and Nevada and the Dakotas and so forth. And a couple of years ago, I got interested in it. By the way, credit where it's due, back when Governor O'Bannon was in office, he and the then Commissioner of Education, I think it was Stan Jones at the time, signed Indiana up as a state participant in this, but it never got here. But I discovered that it ought to fit our situation here too very well. So what we did, I could describe it as a private labeling exercise. We took this great vehicle, brought it to Indiana, put an Indiana label on it, and here's what happens. It is mainly aimed at adults, but anyone can enroll. It is online entirely. It is what they call competency-based. This means that you don't pay for and you don't wait on a semester to move on to the next subject. If you are ready to take a test, Statistics 102, and you pass it with a high enough grade, you can move on immediately. The other distinctive feature of WGU is that the faculty are mentors who are online and on the phone all the time to about 80 students each. And their whole job is to help you succeed. In fact, they are compensated or not based on the success of their students. It is growing very fast. It isn't for everybody, but it is a great opportunity for people who either missed a chance to go to college the first time or got a certain distance and never finished. We got a lot of those. And I think it's a nice complement, PLE complement, to the educational institutions that we have now. We got an awful lot of people in this state who don't have a college degree. But a lot of them actually did some work somewhere back there. And this is mainly aimed at reaching them. They're off to a terrific start. And if you know anybody in that shape, have them look at WGU.
Mitch, there's no front runner of the Republican nominees. Will you and your family acquiesce, change your mind, and
run? I told you the acoustics were not too good in here. I didn't get that question. Let's talk about Indiana if we can. Yes, sir, back there.
Thanks. I'm probably the token Dem here. But I just want to say that the normal Dems really appreciate the service that you've given to this state. I just want to say that because I think it's important. It's been a good middle of the road and listen to both sides. Haven't been taken captive of the right friend or the left friend. And for that, I say thank you.
Well, I can't tell you how much that means. I hear a lot of that. I really do. People will sometimes preface a nice statement by saying that, you know, I'm a Democrat, but, or I didn't vote for you the first time, but, or something. And it always means a lot more. I will tell you that I have told the people who work in our administration, every day of 7 years, we work for everyone equally. It doesn't matter how they vote or if they vote. We are the employees of everyone. That's why that public confidence statistic that I showed you, that survey that the group in New York took, mattered a lot to me. We didn't get, because nobody gets 77% of the vote. But if 77% of the people of the state feel that on balance they're being well served, that somebody cares about doing a good job for them, that matters a lot to us. And so I thank you for your statement, and we will try to live up to it. Yes, ma'am.
Under Daniel's report on the state and the level of indebtedness, I had recently seen a reporter study in Forbes magazine that when you took into account the unfunded pension liability, Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they don't understand what they're talking about, and I'll explain it. I'll explain to you why. You're right. You did see that in one place, and it's completely erroneous. And here's the situation. The teacher's pension fund is in two pieces, and some far-sighted people before we got there started a new one, which is back in the 90s, and it is like our public employees fund, as close to fully funded as anybody in the country is. By the way, we are using, because I told them to, the most conservative discount rate, that is to say, expected return in America. So we're as cautious as anybody. Now, the so-called old teachers fund was never meant to be pre-funded. It was always a pay-as-you-go system, and it is now. So the state, it's about 6 cents, and it's declining, of the state, every state budget dollar. We pay this year's retirees. As long as the state honors that commitment, there'll be no problem. The state actually skipped 2 or 3 years of payments right before we got there in those red years I showed you. And we said, no, bad practice, not doing that anymore. And it's never been done again. So that is not an unfunded plan, because it was never set up to be. It is a pay-as-you-go plan. It's going to disappear over the next couple decades. And that is why we're ranked as high as we are on the fair measure that I showed you. But you did see it correctly. And we've called them up and said, you're missing a big point here. And I hope the next time they report on it, they'll get it right. Yeah. You know, the other day, I think it was Monday, it was a nice thing. They asked me to come out and swear in the newly elected officials at Carmel. So I gladly did. But it was interesting because Mayor Brainerd said something, or somebody said something about intersections. And I said at the time, there was only one thing said here today that puzzled me. What is an intersection? Because if you live near Carmel, you don't see any of them, right? They consider a roundabout an intersection, I understand. Oh, well, I mean, here's the point. Just to back up a couple feet from it, one of the major, major projects that we committed to somehow getting done in this state from an infrastructure and transportation business was a free-flowing U.S. 31 to bring South Bend and Elkhart and those kind of places into closer contact with this state, with the center of the state, and vice versa. And so what you think of a Keystone as a state with statewide responsibility, I think of as the last piece of this billion-dollar project, which is really humming along. With regard to that specific design, I don't know all the details, but our folks believe there is a smaller footprint, less expensive way to do it. Looks like maybe we'll get something worked out there. We will need, I think everybody would agree, we will need, particularly when 31 is fully expanded, a new configuration there, but not necessarily the first one that was on the drawing board. So we're all over it. Matthew.
Sticking with transportation just a little bit, I thought you showed great courage in the bridge issue down by the state of the Ohio River. What's the current status of the bridges and some of that infrastructure?
Okay. Former Representative Whetstone asks about the Sherman-Minton Bridge, and bridges generally. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I looked this morning. We're on a 135-day schedule to get that bridge open again. Imagine if we had to shut down Keystone. I mean, we don't have bridges around here. I don't have an exact analogy to you, but it's very disruptive to have to that area, and we're very eager to get it back in business. So they're marching to a very fast schedule. We'll get it open on March 1. They're on or ahead of schedule now. So unless we get really, really rotten weather. In fact, they'll work in rotten weather. What they tell me, the engineers say they can't take is prolonged super cold weather. Then from a material standpoint, they have to wait. But no, I mean, right now, we're cooking toward a March 1. And by the way, we believe in incentives, whether it's for the frontline worker in government or for a contractor. And so that contractor can make more money or be penalized, depending on whether they can beat that March 1 or not. You know, bridges generally, Indiana, over the period of these few years that we're serving, is rebuilding 21% of its bridges, probably the highest percent in America. And, you know, it's a constant, there's a lot of backlog, but we're working through it. Been a good time, been a really lucky time. I was grousing about our bad luck with the economy and so forth, but I must say it's been a really lucky time to be building at record rates, because there's so little going on in other states. That I've said to some of my friends in the press, you ever think you'd use the term government underrun? Because we are routinely getting bids 20, 25, 30 plus percent below the engineering estimate, just because the competition is hot. Pat's getting out the hook, so we do a couple more. And yes, sir. Well, first of all, I just can't thank you enough. It's a rare citizen, honestly, or organization that puts their energy into something like this, and that's because it's not in the individual or very specific interest of anybody. You're serving the public interest when you argue for a reform like township government. And so thank you very much in your individual capacity or whoever was associated with you. Well, if I had the magic answer, we'd have gotten it done by now. It has been more difficult than I thought it might be. There is a very, it's interesting, people in the General Assembly who disagree about absolutely everything else can come together to defend township government. Really, I mean, there are a lot of rural Republicans who have very sentimental or personal attachment to it. And then there are inner city, usually Democrats, for whom it is a place of patronage, frankly. And so they link arms. I think if we move down the trail of local options, so letting people make the decision, I think you'd have a lot of jurisdictions decide to modernize. And that would, in turn, create an incentive, maybe pressure or example for the rest to follow. But that's the best I can do for you on that. Just simply doing it in one stroke, we're over two or three.
Brag on the BMV.
Brag on the BMV? Well, I don't have to. You guys do, or citizens do. We test customer satisfaction two or three different ways, and it's always, it floats around 97%. They've won national awards. Very proud of them. You know, I'll tell you something I haven't really talked about the BMV. You know, we almost have to watch them now not to push so far for, let's say, speed. You know, the average visit time last month, 7 or 8 minutes. I've told them, I don't want you to sacrifice. We're not telling you that, you know, you necessarily have to get to 5 minutes. I don't want you to sacrifice quality or accuracy or any of these things. So that's a good problem to have. But it is a great success story, and we're so proud of the people who have led it. And we've got people from other states coming here all the time trying to, as you'd say, benchmark this, because it's a license branches are a pain in the neck in most places. We were not alone. Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could give us an idea of one or two places that we might want to visit.
Oh, Myra, there's so many. Yeah, I've been. Well, I have been everywhere. You know, it happened again last night. You know, I always chat up the young people when I see them, and I was talking to some young gal somewhere. And, you know, I say, "Where are you from?" She says, oh, Eastern Indiana. I go, okay, fine. Where? She said, oh, toward Richmond. I said, yeah, I know, but... She said, well, just out sort of northeast of Newcastle. I said, come on, Danielle, where? She said, Modoc. I said, I've been there three times. I know Modoc, you know. Just tell me. Okay, let's see. I'll give you a couple quick ones. If you haven't spent much time in the Lake Kent country in northeast Indiana, a lot of Hoosiers, it seemed to me not to know much about it. I'm talking about up around Angola and LaGrange and up in there. There's some gorgeous places, mainly summertime, but there, you know, it's a land of lakes and it's very beautiful. I would certainly recommend the area around Metamora down in southeast Indiana. There's some that's easy to get to from here. Now, if you haven't been down to see what's happened at French Lick, get down there and that area. But the last one I'll say, and to some extent this is a suggestion, a little bit of a suggestion for tomorrow, but if you haven't been out to Goose Pond, you don't even have to be a bird watcher or a nature lover to just fall in love with a place like that. And we are at work on, Goose Pond is over toward Linton. And it, at the time we completed it, 8,000 to 9,000 acres, it was the largest single conservation project in Indiana. Now we're working on one down around Seymour, more or less, right now that is three times that big along the Muscatatuck River. And we're working on one along the Wabash that's going to be five times that big. And so some of these places I'm talking about will really come into their own over the next few years. But we are just so committed to this era being by far the biggest ever in terms of conservation and protection of Indiana's natural beauty that there'll be a lot of places for you to visit soon that weren't there before. I'll quit on a favorite story when, because it applies to so many other things. I've always said, you know, we had a lot of catching up to do in Indiana and that things took too long. We're always in a hurry. So on the day we did the official opening of Goose Pond, there were a lot of people down there who had been working on it literally for a generation or more. And whenever we do one of these, road project, conservation, whatever it is, I look around, try to find the most elderly person and go say hi. And that's what I did. There's this old guy there, and I said, so you've been interested in this a long time? He said, I've been working on this since I was a kid. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, I did. I never thought the day would come. He said, you know, so many times we thought we had this thing nailed. He said, one time we were so sure that of success that we held a celebratory parade in the streets of Linton. And he said, but then events intervened. I said, that's too bad. What events? He said, the Korean War. So, you know, if we sometimes seem like we're in a hurry or we're sometimes seem like we're forcing the action, it's because we think some good things waited too long in Indiana, but they don't have to wait anymore. Thanks a lot.